Willkommen beim Podcast der Yacht, Europas größtem Segelmagazin. Hier geht's um Boote, Segelpraxis, Menschen und Abenteuer. Um alles, was ihr über das schönste Hobby der Welt wissen müsst. Segeln für die Ohren.
Heute gibt's den ersten Live-Podcast von der Yacht. Wir sind nämlich auf der Boot in Düsseldorf mit einem riesigen Stand des Verlags Delius Klasing. Und gestern hatten wir Pip Herr zu Besuch. Sie ist wahrscheinlich die im Moment bekannteste Seglerin der Welt. Pip ist die Vendée Globe gesegelt, lag auf Platz 10, war im Südmeer richtig gut unterwegs und aus dem Nichts brach ihr Mast. Und dann hat sie sich einen Notrigg gebaut und ist 700 Meilen Richtung Norden nach oben nach Down Under gesegelt und wurde da von Zehntausenden von Menschen begrüßt. Und Pip hat das alles auf Videos festgehalten, wie sie verzweifelt war, geweint hat, sich den Menschen geöffnet hat, von ihren Ängsten erzählt hat und von ihrer Fahrt zurück. Und gestern war sie bei uns am Stand und sie hat gezeigt, was für eine große Persönlichkeit sie ist.
Es war für alle, die hier sind, so bewegend, was damals passiert ist. Und dieses Mitfiebern und Mitfühlen. Und sie hat sich so geöffnet, allein da draußen in dieser Hölle, die sie durchgemacht hat. Und deshalb, ich bin unfassbar dankbar, dass Pip Herr hier bei uns ist, dass sie aus Australien jetzt über London hier hingeflogen ist, unter anderem unseretwegen. Und mir ist es eine totale Ehre, jemanden wie Pip zu interviewen. Und ich weiß, euch geht's auch so, hier zu sein mit ihr. Wahnsinn. Pip, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
We've been talking in there already, behind the scenes. I think you don't know what a star you have become in the last weeks, do you?
No. And it makes me feel deeply uncomfortable. But yeah, I mean, I guess I'm just doing what I've always done. I'm doing the thing that I love and sharing it. And that's it, really.
You showed everybody your emotions, your tears. Later on, you've been laughing again. And we all thought, wow, what a resilient, strong, honest person. And we all fell in love with you.
I guess it was just, you know, when the mask came down, the feelings of devastation are just, I mean, they still hurt immensely. To lose a four-year project in a matter of seconds, it's really, you don't think that you can be hurt that much in a matter of seconds. And, you know, when the mask came down, I it wasn't the fact that the mask was broken. It was the loss of everything. And not just for me, for my team, for my sponsors, for our supporters, you know, the fact that I never got to write the end of the story. And I did have concerns about whether, you know, I would have a future beyond that, because I'm 50 years old now, and who would have thought kind of 20 years ago that 50-year-old women would be sailing fully foiling emukas around the world. So there was a lot to lose and a lot to doubt. But actually, I think kind of there's two elements to it. One element is, you know, when you're alone in the middle of the ocean and you have a problem, you cannot just curl up in a ball and hope someone else is going to solve it for you. You have to be the solution to your problem, practically. So practically, I had to stand up. I had to cut the rig free. I had to make sure that my situation did not get any worse. And then I had to get myself to the shore. And that was really important to me, because I put myself in that situation. I was in no danger at all. And I had the wherewithal to rescue myself. So it was really important that I did that and I didn't just put up my hand and say, someone else has to get me now. And then next to that practical element, there's the emotional element, which sort of mirrors it. You know, in the journey towards the shore, I needed to kind of heal myself emotionally and work out, you know, what the future looked like and that there was a future and kind of find my hope and my joy and my passion again, and that kind of came with recovering myself, I guess.
You were at the flagship night yesterday introducing the new Seamaster, and Cobra was out there in the Southern Ocean, and we saw these videos where she also cried because in the race she was in, somebody else had a mast break. And she was crying. How did you feel in that moment? Did you have tears in your eyes too?
No, I didn't actually. I mean, it's made me think about all the other dismastings that have happened through the fleet. And actually, it is a bit of a problem in the Amoca fleet at the moment. We have four per year. And the last one to me was Roman Atanasio, who dismasted in September and had to do a huge crowd fund to get going again just before the Vendée. And I really, really felt for him. You know, we were trying to, all the teams were trying to support him. We were trying to see if we could give him sails and stuff like that. It definitely made me kind of reflect on, I don't think I had felt that, because I hadn't felt the loss of a dismasting. I think I looked at it previously more transactionally. It's just kind of, oh, they dismasted, that happens, that's a shame. I think I take it more personally now.
Why is that a problem, the dismasting? Like, what's built wrongly, probably, that it happens all the time?
It's not for me to kind of say now, because I don't have all of the details, but essentially what has happened in the fleet is we have a one design mast that was designed in 2012, and the boats are getting more and more powerful. And so, you know, I think the loads, especially the dynamic loads, when you fly and you land, can be extreme. And so any kind of weaknesses are being found out. But we are about to go on to a V2 version of the mast, which hopefully should help things.
So then you sailed back to Australia and you said it wasn't a big deal. You just had to put up your jury sail and then you sailed back. And it probably wasn't a big deal because it's just a little sail, just, what was it, 700 miles?
It didn't feel like that much of a big deal, no. No, it was just, I guess the main thing was I could have just put the jury rig up and just left the storm jib up and then just kind of waddled along. But I guess the difference was that I decided I was going to do something every day. During the days, I just didn't want to sit around waiting till I got to Australia. So I decided during the days I would basically just kind of rev up my boat as much as I could. And that became a fun task. So kind of attaching a new clue point to the storm jib. And then I cut up one of my old sails and I made a trysail. And then I started moving weight around. And then kind of on a day when there was no wind, I took the mast down and I did an inspection and I made my runner tails more sleek. And I was kind of just, my brother dared me. He basically said, if you can get foiling on a jury rig, I will buy you wine for a year. So I was trying really hard, but my best...
That didn't work, did it?
No, but I did get 8.4 knots at one stage, which was just outrageous, and it just became fun.
It just shows how good the boats are. You know, on that rig, getting 8 knots is impossible.
Well, I suppose I adapted to it quite quickly as well, and when I came into the shore, so the people of Melbourne just blew me away with the reception that I got there. It just staggered me that all these people who have no reason at all to care about me or my boat turned up to help me. They organized every single part of my arrival was organized, and the crew came out in a powerboat in foul weather and met me the night before and basically escorted me in through the heads at Port Phillip. When they came to meet me, they took a photo and sent it to me on WhatsApp. And I guess I'd adapted to my boat. I'd been kind of living my boat and it'd become normal. And I couldn't believe the size of the mast when they sent it. I just couldn't believe it was so small. I'd thought it was so big. And I was really disappointed, actually, with the sail area when I saw it.
How was it to meet people again after all that time? You know, to hug people, to touch people, like to talk to people. How was that? How is that? I can't imagine after, what was it, 6-7 weeks?
It's strange. They were all laughing because they kept offering to come on the boat with me. So when you arrive in Australia, you're not allowed to have other people on the boat with you. But they'd contacted Border Force and said that this could be a safety issue. Border Force said, yeah, fine, people can get on. And they kept radioing me and saying, do you want us to transfer people on now? And I was like, no. do you need some help? No. So they came over and they gave me a massive big hamper full of fruit and some tea because I'd run out of tea, which quite frankly is a rookie effort.
For a Brit, it's the worst.
I know. I'm so ashamed of myself. Nobody got on until I was kind of coming into berth. So it takes a whole day to get across Port Phillip Bay. So I'd spent the whole day on my own. But during the day, loads of people who were out racing had come over and waved at me and said hi. So I had a gradual integration. And then it was just a lot of talking.
Yeah, yeah. Right. I could see it yesterday. Everybody wanted something from you. Everybody wanted to talk to you. And I just thought, oh my God, poor Pip. You look like you just want to go home. Like, go back to your boat. And now you're sitting here again with me and with all these people. And you have to be in front of all these people. And behind the scenes, you just told me, you even erased Facebook and Instagram and all the social media from your phone before, even on board. How is it for you now to sit here with all these people, everybody staring at you, everybody wanting something from you? Is it too much?
No, it's the other side of what I do. And I love what I do. I love being alone in the ocean because I'm massively dedicated to my sport. And that for me, the amazing thing about a race like the Vendée is that I am allowed to be effectively in a flow state for months. No interruptions, no expectations. I just focus on my sport and my sailing, and it means so much to me. And it is about competition. It's all about competition. But the flip side is that, you know, when we are sailing, you know, at elite level, we have sponsorships, you know, we have a commitment to talk about what we're doing. And I'm very passionate about trying to make sailing more accessible and trying to kind of increase an audience, which hopefully will bring more sponsors into the sport, but also will encourage more people to take note, to try and get involved, to feel like it's a sport that they can follow. So this is important to me, and I will never not answer a question someone asks me.
I think you also bring sailing on land. You know, we can follow you. We can follow others all the time. And all of a sudden we're on land and we know now much better what happens out there. And that's it. We are at home on land and we follow you on sea. And I think that's what you're doing. And that is so important that we all understand what you do and how rough it is out there. Can you explain us a little how it is when you sail on your own?
Yeah. I think one of the things that it has been quite difficult to do is to properly represent the brutality of the boats as they are now. I mean, it's not all brutal. You know, there are moments that are, you know, beautiful sunsets gliding along flat water, 10 knots of wind. You know, they're utterly relatable. They're fantastic moments. You know, particularly in the Indian Ocean this time, we had 2 weeks of just brutality. There is no other word for it. The boats are, their motion is massively unpredictable. So the acceleration and deceleration is huge. My top speed was 39.6 knots, which is disappointing because it's not 40. I mean, why? It means I've got to go and try and do that again. And you can go from that to 14 knots, you know, and the boat stops, but the human being doesn't. Every single tiny movement that you make has to be thought out. You've got to think, what happens if, how do I get there? How do I move across here? You know, and that then means that you need this extraordinary level of motivation, because if it takes you kind of a full cycle of 4 minutes to get up out of your chair, get across the cockpit, ease the main sheet by 2 centimeters and get back to your chair, then you're not going to do that unless you really, really have a good reason. So, you know, the competition element of it requires a huge amount of dedication and motivation. Sleeping is just, I mean, eventually you do sleep because you're exhausted, but we're sleeping in kind of 30-minute bites, and then I would try and find a two-hour section if the weather was stable. So you're sleeping little and often, but sleeping itself is, I mean, every single part of your brain is saying, okay, the boat's doing 30 knots and you want to do what? You know, trying to get your brain to accept that this is normal and you can make a cup of tea, you can sleep. You know, trying to even navigate a screen, trying to type. Like, I mean, I've written some hilarious emails where just so extra letters thrown in absolutely everywhere. Someone needs to decode them at the end because, you know, you can't do these normal everyday things. Underneath this enormous stress and this mental challenge that's facing you all the time, there is the most incredible amount of adrenaline and I guess a feeling of just excitement and accomplishment and wonder, because, you know, even though my boat is three generations old, if you think about it, think about the design that has gone into making a 60-foot flying boat that goes around the world. Think about the skill and the technology, the boat building, the autopilot algorithms that allow me to sail a boat like that at 35 knots while I'm asleep. I mean, all of those things are just human beings firing on all cylinders, coming together to make a project that I get to drive in the most extreme places. And I'd love it. I love it.
Yeah, I totally understand. It's such a big project. So many people, so much money, so much responsibility for you especially. And then this mast comes down. When did you decide, I'm going to go for the Vendée Globe 2028?
It probably took me about 24 hours, I would say, to kind of lick my wounds, really. I had, immediately when the mast came down, I kind of went into survival mode. So I was just working, cutting the rig free. I kind of cried initially, and then actually while I was getting the rig free, making sure the boat was okay, I was almost happy, kind of, I was contented, I would say, because I knew what I was doing. I was just working, I was helping myself, and so it allowed me not to think about the bigger picture. And then I got my jury rig up and started sailing, and then just kind of, I guess, you know, the adrenaline spike disappears and you're mentally, physically exhausted. So I kind of spent 24 hours just not really doing a lot, sitting on a beanbag, crying a lot, you know, feeling pretty desperate and thinking that my career was over. And then, you know, you kind of come out the other side and you realize, well, you can't just sit here wallowing in your own tears for 2 weeks. So you got to make things a little bit better. You start making things a bit better on the boat. And then, you know, I just feel it all my life since I first read about the Vendée when I was 17 years old. I've had this ember inside me that's just been burning and burning and burning because I knew it was the sport for me. I just knew it was what I wanted to do. And now I've done it. That fire is even bigger. And, you know, after 24 hours, I could feel it was still there. And then I reflected on 4 years of work, on what we, my team, have achieved over 4 years, and how proud I am and how far we've come. And I'm not ready just to let that go. There's more we can do. I still feel I can grow as a sailor. I still feel I've got more to give. I want to sail around the world again. You know, I need to do it. I need to do it 100%.
You know, now you're not only a sailor anymore. You're a manager. You're a boat builder. You have to deal with money, people, sponsors, everything. When you started the idea of doing the Vendée Globe, did you know what that means?
You know, I guess I was fully aware of what a Vendée Globe team looked like. And I knew that my path was to create my own team. I knew I would never get a job as a skipper in someone else's team. So, yeah, that's what drove me to build my team. But I think I'm probably the most reluctant business person in the world. it's not something that I know a huge amount about. I've had to really learn about contracts, about commercial partnerships, about running a team, about HR, about, you know, all of those things. I mean, the practical elements of it, I'm really happy with. And actually, if I could have just grabbed a spanner and worked on the boat for 4 years, I would have been super happy. Yeah, the other side of things has just been a learning process. And it's not something I particularly enjoy, but it is necessary to get the thing I enjoy. So I give it as much as I've got.
And do you like it?
No.
For me, it's a shift from, like, in the 90s and 2000s, it was probably the Formula One in car driving. And it's kind of shifting into sailing now. That means all these Vendée Globe people, they will become Mika Häkkinens and Michael Schumachers and whatever they're called sooner or later. Maybe not that big, but still big. Is it the same in England? Do people perceive you as we do in Germany? Because we have Boris Herrmann. Is it the same in England that you are like one of those people?
No, 100% not. No.
Really?
No, 100% not. And it's a really interesting comparison that you draw because, you know, one of the big challenges that I have finding sponsorship in the UK is that the sport isn't particularly well known. And there are lots of preconceptions about sailing in the UK, which is basically that it's an elite sport for rich people. And, you know, I really try hard to break those perceptions down. And when I'm trying to explain to people what we do, then I always say it's like Formula One, and it absolutely is. You know, we have our vessel, which is the car. It's high tech. We have technicians who work on it. I'm supported by a wider team. We go around the world to race starts. There's a race village. You know, there's opportunities to come and see the teams and the boats at work. The big difference with what we do is that the pit lanes are open to everyone and you have to change your own tires.
Yeah. So when you came back to England, it was no big deal. Like, there was nobody waiting for you at the airport and cheering and saying, Pip Hare's back.
I didn't tell anyone I was coming back.
You know, the world's been changing in the last years, and especially feminism has become so strong and empowerment of women and all that. How do you see your role in this whole movement?
My journey has been difficult because, you know, I left school at 18 in the early 1990s, and I wanted a job as a professional sailor, and I pretty much got laughed at. You know, it's been hard. And I can see change, which is great. You know, I think it wouldn't be so hard for me now. My biggest wish is to be judged on merit. That's all. And that's why I love our sport. Because solo ocean racing is, you know, one of the few sports where men and women do compete on equal terms. And it really works because nobody is strong enough to muscle one of those boats around. Your stature really has nothing to do with it. It's how you manage yourself. It's your technique. Everybody's different and everybody has different strengths. And the longer the race, the more level the playing field becomes. And that's why I love it. And all I ask is that I get judged on my actions. You know, I don't want to be the ex-female sailor in the fleet. I want to be the ex-sailor in the fleet. And I think that's where we've got, certainly me, Sam, Justine, you know, I think definitely we are judged in that way. And I hope that that kind of just helps people think in those terms going forwards. But I also hope that it gives a green light to anybody, not just women, you know, anybody who doesn't feel like they fit in, that, you know, they can have a future in this sport, that they can find a way of sailing that will work for them. And I guess if it's made a tiny change, then I'm happy.
Now that you've become so famous, you have a lot of influence on people too. You say something and they might take it serious or think, wow, Pip said it, so it has to be true. Are you aware of that pressure?
I mean, in terms of how I operate, you know, I've always tried to make sure that I operate with integrity. You know, that's really, really important to me. I tell the truth. You know, I tell my truth, but it is my truth. And that doesn't mean it's right.
It's so important for all of us to have an idol there, to have an honest, heart-open person. And good luck for the Vendée Globe 2028. We will follow you. Thank you very much, Pip.
Thank you.
Das war der Segelpodcast der Yacht. Alle 2 Wochen neu, immer freitags. Wenn es euch gefallen hat, abonniert uns, liked uns, empfehlt uns oder schreibt uns an podcast@yacht.de. Und wenn ihr mehr auf die Ohren braucht, klickt unbedingt auf Meilen und Zeilen, der Abenteuer-Podcast des Delius Klasing Verlags. Nur bei uns gibt's echte Abenteuer direkt ins Ohr.